When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Nothing's better than feeling comfortable in your own shoes. Maybe you're a parent raising a little rock star or a tech nomad working from anywhere. Allbirds wants you to be comfortable in your actual shoes too. Their wool runners, pipers, and loungers are so cozy you might forget you're wearing them. And they're crafted from natural materials that tread lightly on our planet. So get comfortable in your shoes. Get to know the wool runners, pipers, and loungers at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
On the night of October 20th, 1967, journalist Betty Allen was working late at the offices of the Times Standard newspaper, based out of Eureka, a vibrant seaport town at the northwestern edge of California, when a call came into the office. Picking it up, she was greeted by the urgent and excited voice of 34-year-old Roger Patterson. Patterson was calling from the Lower Trinity Ranger Station out in Willow Creek, a small mountain town about 40 miles to the east, a popular spot from which to venture out into the vast and ancient forests that surrounded it on all sides. Patterson's words, as Betty later described it, cascaded out between gasps as he did his best to precisely detail the events from earlier that day. It all started around 1:30 p.m. that afternoon, when he and his friend, 36-year-old Bob Gimlin, were riding through the Six Rivers Nation Forest along Bluff Creek, a tributary of the Klamath River, deep within the forest, about 40 miles north of Willow Creek. A few years previously, an almighty flood had forced a torrent of rainwater through the narrow waterway, leaving behind fallen trees and branches that now littered the banks, strewn about in huge piles of bleached driftwood. Patterson and Gimlin were just approaching one such pile when they caught sight of something moving at the far side of it, about 80 to 90 feet away. To the pair's amazement, it was some kind of hominid, measuring well over 6 feet tall, with silvery brown hair all over its body, and it was just standing alone, right in front of them. Patterson, who had a film camera with him, was just about to reach for it when his horse reared up suddenly, throwing him to the ground. With the horse agitating to get away, Patterson had just enough time to grab the camera from his saddlebag before the horse bolted into the trees. As the bizarre creature began to move away from them, without thinking, Patterson ran toward it, hoping to get a better angle, while Gimlin followed on horseback. Then Gimlin's horse also reared up, forcing him to dismount and let it go. With the two men now on foot, Patterson yelled for Gimlin to cover him with his rifle as he moved in a little closer and pressed the shutter release lever. With the blood rushing through their ears and only the sound of the film whirring round in the camera to break the silence, the pair could only stand awestruck as they watched the creature slowly amble away from them, its arms hanging almost to its knees, swinging languidly by its side as it went, as Patterson put it. The two men then watched with disbelief as the creature turned to regard them for a moment before it simply sloped off and disappeared into the trees. As Patterson, who believed the creature was female owing to the shape of its chest, went on to say, "She never made a sound. She wasn't hostile to us, but we don't think she was afraid of us either. She acted like she didn't want anything to do with us if she could avoid it. But she stunk, like a dog coming out of the rain that smelled like it had been rolling in something dead." The footage that Roger Patterson shot, known today as the Patterson and Gimlin film, was the first time that anyone claimed to have caught the mythical forest creature, known to some as Bigfoot or Sasquatch, on camera. As a consequence, the film, in particular the still that was taken from it, known as Frame 352, showing the precise moment the apparent creature turned to look directly at the camera, instantly transformed what was a local legend into a global phenomenon. Although the film failed to gain any credible support, leading to accusations that Patterson and Gimlin had faked the entire thing, supporters of its veracity are quick to point out that it hasn't been satisfactorily debunked either. As for Patterson, the film was the culmination of an 8-year mission to find irrefutable evidence of the forest creature, which began after he first read about it in a True magazine article in 1959. The author of the article was Ivan T. Sanderson, whose fascination with mythical creatures led him to coin the phrase cryptozoology, a portmanteau of three ancient Greek words, which translates roughly to English as the study of hidden animals. In a later book, which also served as inspiration to Patterson, Sanderson made note of a number of footprints and strange occurrences that had been reported by forestry workers in the Bluff Creek region. Chief among them was the story of Jerry Crewe, who in August 1958 was helping to build a timber road through the surrounding forest of Bluff Creek when he apparently discovered a series of 16-inch human-like footprints in the dirt. A subsequent article detailing Crewe's incredible story, written in the Humboldt Times by journalist Andrew Genzoli, is thought to be the first instance in which the term Bigfoot was used in relation to such things. In truth, of course, tales of strange and terrifying creatures stalking the ancient forests of the Pacific Northwest had long been shared and traded, first by the Native American people of the region, and later by the newcomers. For many Bigfoot enthusiasts, however, there is one story above all others that they will often come back to, the one that really makes the hair stand up on the back of their necks. And for that, we need to move a little deeper into the forest, to a place known today as Ape Canyon. You're listening to Unexplained, and I'm Richard McLean Smith. We often talk about how the advent of streaming has revolutionized the way we engage with audio and visual content, placing countless numbers of films, TV shows, and music tracks at our fingertips. But did you know this has also been happening for books, too? Described as the Netflix for books, Scribd is quite simply the largest digital library in the world, and all of it accessible from your favorite device. With Scribd, you get instant access to millions of ebooks, audiobooks, magazines, and more. As a user myself, Scribd has been invaluable for me as a resource, giving me access to a huge range of sources that have helped inform many of the stories featured on Unexplained. Enjoy instant access to Scribd's entire library for less than the cost of a single book, and discover must-read new work from celebrated authors like Roxane Gay, Charles Yu, and more, premiering exclusively on Scribd. Right now, Scribd is offering our listeners a free 60-day trial. Go to tryscribd.com try.try.com/unexplained for your free trial. That's try.scribd.com/unexplained to get 60 days of Scribd for free. Fred Beck always had the sense that he was a little different, as if strange things would just happen to him. One time, when he was playing in the pastures as a child, Fred realised he'd lost his precious bean shooter, a favourite toy that he'd worked weeks to save up the money to afford. As he began to cry over it, a mysterious woman appeared and told him not to be sad, because his shooter would be waiting for him when he got home. Wiping the tears away, a somewhat unconvinced Fred swiftly made his way back home, where no sooner had he stepped inside, he caught sight of the toy lying before him on the kitchen table. He never saw the woman again, and as it turned out, the bean shooter wasn't even the same one he'd bought. Born in 1888, Fred grew up in Kelso, 40 miles north of Portland in Washington, USA, a small but bustling hub at the confluence of the Cowlitz and Columbia rivers that was quickly establishing itself as the epicenter of the local logging industry. There, Fred would spend his days down by the banks of the Columbia, watching the giant steamers drift by, or out roaming the surrounding countryside. While in town, week after week, trainloads of loggers piled in, who seemed to spend as much time frequenting the many taverns and other late-night spots of the town as they did shifting wood. With little other work to be found, it was only natural that Fred would one day end up in the logging trade too. By 1918, however, he had his sights set on something a little more financially rewarding. It was back in 1891 that two farmers on a hunting trip near Spirit Lake, 50 miles east of Kelso, discovered what they recognised to be mineral deposits of black tourmaline and hematite, minerals that were often found near rich veins of precious metals. Their discovery triggered a minor gold rush in the area that by 1910 had seen thousands of prospect pits and 11,000 feet of tunnels dug out of the area, yielding several thousand tons of gold, silver and copper ore. A geological review soon after, however, suggested the region was in no danger of becoming the next Klondike, and by 1916, most attempts to develop substantial mines in the area had been all but abandoned. There still remained a few hardy individuals, however, for whom the dream of striking it rich had yet to evaporate. And soon, having tired of the usual odds and sods jobs back in Kelso, Fred Beck decided it was high time that he gave it a go, too. In 1918, Fred teamed up with his father-in-law, Marion Smith, and Marion's son, Roy, along with their friends, Gabe Lefevre and John Patterson, to stake out an area of forest known as the Lewis River area, located just south of Spirit Lake at the foot of Mount St. Helens, a breathtaking cone-shaped volcano that loomed high over the surrounding landscape. Those early days would be spent scouring the area together for the perfect place to begin prospecting. They trekked endlessly through the forest with rifles in hand should they find themselves suddenly in the path of a big black bear or a hungry cougar, occasionally chancing upon the eerie sight of a long-forgotten mining cabin. Whenever the men found a good spot, they would put up camp, then spend the days blasting into bedrock or tunneling into cliffs, looking for the telltale signs of gold, while nights would be spent gathered round the campfire with a pot of beans, smoking pipes and gazing up at the endless night sky as they were serenaded by the nocturnal movements of the forest. It is one of the many mistaken assumptions about the great outdoors that it is a quiet, peaceful place, when in truth, it is an eternal cacophony of unhuman things, from the hooting and chirping of birds to the chitter of insects and the many barks and howls of unseen, fur-covered creatures. One night, however, Fred's group heard something else that none of them had heard before. A strange thumping sound coming from somewhere far off that was met by another similar sound soon after, coming from some other distant place. It sounded for all the world as if they were responding to each other. The men thought little of it until the next day, when they heard it again, this time in broad daylight, with one of the men later describing it as sounding as though there was a hollow drum in the earth somewhere, and something was hitting it. Having all heard the tales of strange ape-like creatures that were said to roam the surrounding hills, the men were quick to joke about just what might be out there, but Fred didn't see the funny side. Back in the 1900s, while working at a logging camp just outside of Kelso with his brother, he and Fred were just bedding down for the night when they heard something snorting and kicking about outside their tent. Then it started pushing against the side of the tent. As the men cowered inside, doing their best to stay completely still, they took it in turns to keep watch outside through a small slit in the canvas, through which they could just about make out something large, covered in dark hair, ambling about under the moonlight. The following morning, Fred's brother couldn't hide his relief at their lucky escape from a possible bear attack, but Fred couldn't share his elation. He'd seen enough bears in his time, and whatever that thing was, it was no bear. One morning, a few years after they began prospecting, Fred's group were camped out in the eastern shadow of Mount St. Helens in an area known as Pumice Butte when Fred's father-in-law, Marion, set out early to fetch water from a nearby creek. When he returned soon after, he hurriedly woke up the others and told them to follow him immediately. 20 minutes later, the bleary-eyed men were stepping grumpily through the trickling waters of the creek, demanding to know what all the fuss was about, as Marion led them onto a sandbar running through the middle of it and pointed toward the ground. The men stared down in disbelief at what looked like two huge footprints, similar to a human's but far, far bigger, each pressed about 4 inches deep into the sand. Fred looked up and scoured the surrounding hills, gripping his rifle a little tighter. By 1922, having thankfully seen no further evidence of anything untoward, the men had decided to focus their efforts on a portion of cliff on the eastern side of Mount St. Helens in an area known as the Plains of Abraham. According to Fred, many years later, they'd apparently been led there by a Native American spirit guide with the tantalizing promise that their fortune would be found within it. Having spotted a ledge partway up the cliff, the men swiftly levered themselves up to it, and with the use of explosive powder, blasted out a much larger ledge from which they were able to start tunneling into the cliff face. Soon sensing they could be onto something, the men staked a claim on the land, and soon after built a log cabin at the base of the cliff where they could stay. Though not especially big, and with no windows, it was a solid, cozy construction comprised of pine logs, with a stone fireplace, and enough room to comfortably sleep all 5 of them. It wasn't long after they moved into the region, however, that strange things began to happen. One afternoon, after working the tunnel, the men returned to the cabin to find their items had been interfered with. At first, they suspected a bear had just passed by looking for food, until Fred discovered that their food store had been left completely untouched. Another time, they found an entire sack of canned food emptied onto the ground, with the bag tossed to the side, but no sign of claw marks to be found anywhere. What they did apparently find, however, were a number of strange footprints that looked just like the others they'd seen in the creek. For the next 2 years, the men spent their time chipping away at the vein of ore inside the cliff, then walking the chunks of it down in bags to Marion's Ford, which he kept parked at the foot of the mountain. The ore would be driven back to the nearest town and analysed for its mineral content. Though they never hauled anything life-changing, they found enough to suggest that something big might be just within their grasp. One morning in July 1924, Marion was chipping at the rock face when a large chunk of it fell to the ground. Marion picked it up and smiled as it sparkled in the light. "This is it," he told the others. "I think we're getting close." Fred was unable to share his enthusiasm, however, having been suffering with throbbing toothache for the last 12 hours. But when he asked Marion to give him a lift into town to get it seen to, Marion refused, too excited by the prospect of that morning's find. By the end of the day, however, the team had failed to uncover anything else significant and eventually returned more or less empty-handed to the cabin. After another meal of hotcakes and beans, it was Fred and Marion's turn to fetch more water. The pair grabbed their guns and water bottles accordingly and promptly headed off down the mountain to the nearest spring. Moments later, having just stepped through the tree line, Marion froze suddenly and raised his rifle. "Don't move," he whispered sharply. Then Fred saw it too. About 100 yards ahead of them, on the other side of the narrow canyon, poking out from behind a pine tree. It was hard to make out what it was exactly, only that it was some kind of huge ape-like creature, standing at least 7 feet tall and covered in dark fur. Fred was just stepping round to get a better look when Marion suddenly opened fire, sending bark flying from the pine tree as the creature made a break for it. The men watched incredulous as it ducked and weaved between the trees, clearly moving on two legs, before it eventually disappeared out of sight. "Don't worry about that devil, Fred. I got him right in the head," said Marion proudly. When Fred and Marion returned to the cabin, they wasted no time in telling the others what had just happened, warning them that the creature could well return. Much to their dismay, however, the men were a little less than impressed, accusing the pair of being drunk or mistaking a black bear for something else. And before long, Fred and Marion were questioning their own account too, agreeing that it probably was just a bear after all. After a quick smoke around the fireplace, the men decided to call it a night and each made their way to their beds, with two sharing a long bunk bed and the others sleeping on pine boughs that they'd scattered on the floor. It had just gone midnight when Fred was awoken by a tremendous thud ringing out from the cabin wall, followed by Marion screaming as he sat up suddenly, frantically waving his gun around in the air. As the rest of the group jumped up from their beds, Fred hurriedly lit a lamp, revealing a large pile of chinking next to Marion, which had just been knocked loose from the wall. Then another almighty thump rang out around them. Marion hissed for Fred to put out the light. In the pitch-black silence, as the men's breathing settled, they soon began to hear things shuffling about outside the cabin, like a small herd of horses loping about. Marion held his finger to his lips, then bent down and peered out of the gap in the wall, then threw his head back in horror. "There's three of them," he whispered, but was suddenly interrupted by another round of thumps against the wall, this time from what sounded like rocks being thrown against the cabin. Just then, a flurry of rocks tumbled down the chimney, causing the men to jump back into the room, and then something heavy was heard, moving about above them. "They're on the roof," said Fred aghast. With the sound above moving closer to the middle of the cabin, The men backed up against each other, their rifles pointed at the ceiling, when Marion suddenly let rip, sending a flurry of bullets through the roof. Then something pounded at the front door. "Quick, grab something," yelled Marion, as Fred pulled a pole from the bed and hurriedly pushed it up against the door as the other three backed further away into the cabin. When another thump came against the door, Fred fired off a few more rounds at it, sending splinters of wood everywhere and filling the cabin with gun smoke. Just then, something dark and hairy reached through the hole in the cabin and grabbed hold of an axe that was lying against the cabin wall. Fred was just quick enough to twist the head of it so it couldn't be pulled out. Then another shot rang out from Marion, missing Fred's hand by inches. As quick as it had appeared, the hairy limb dropped the axe and retracted through the hole, giving Fred just enough time to kick the axe away from the wall. Things then calmed for a moment, before another flurry of bangs from outside was met with another volley of bullets from Marion and Fred, until finally it was all over and everything stilled. And so things remained until the first light of dawn crept in through the gap in the chinking and the numerous bullet holes that covered the wall. Satisfied that the cabin was no longer surrounded, Fred removed the pole from the door and cautiously stepped out into the fresh morning air. Then he saw what he took to be one of the creatures standing about 80 yards away on the edge of the gorge. Grabbing his Winchester, Fred darted out toward it, then took aim and fired three times, watching with satisfaction as the thing stiffened for a moment and then tumbled down into the canyon below.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Sign up today and start communicating in less than 48 hours. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. You can also log into your account anytime to send a message to your counselor. BetterHelp is not a crisis line, nor self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online with a broad range of expertise available. And with BetterHelp's commitment to facilitating great therapeutic matches, they make it especially easy and free to change counselors to help you find the right fit. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Unexplained listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/unexplained. That's betterhelp.com/unexplained. Join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
At the first opportunity that morning, the men grabbed everything they could and hightailed it to Marion's truck at the bottom of the mountain, running off in such haste that they were forced to leave almost $200 worth of supplies behind, $3,500 in today's money. Once in the truck, Marion did his best to keep it steady as they bumped and skidded over the rutted earth, while the others kept their rifles trained on the forest either side of them at all times. It was about half an hour later when they pulled into the Spirit Lake Ranger Station to inform Ranger William Welch about all that had happened, with Marion insisting they'd been attacked by some kind of mountain devil. Back in their hometown of Kelso, although Fred told the others not to mention anything about it, it wasn't long before word of their bizarre encounter with an apparent race of terrifying hominid creatures got out. On July 12th, the story hit the press, appearing in an article published in the Portland Oregonian. A few days later, Fred Beck returned to the cabin, this time accompanied by Rangers William Welch and J.H. Huffman. Where first, he pointed out the spot that he'd shot one of the creatures before it tumbled into the gorge. But when the three men peered over to look at the 400-foot drop below, there was no sign of anything matching Fred's description. At the cabin, however, They found a number of large rocks scattered about the building. Then Welch spotted something in the earth and motioned for Huffman to come over and take a look. It was what appeared to be a gigantic, human-like footprint. Huffman studied the shape of it for a moment, then bent down on his haunches and pressed his palm into the ground next to it. Then, with his knuckles, he placed 5 indentations at the top of the first impression and stood back up. Side by side, the prints looked almost identical. Over the next few days, rumours swirled about the men's story, with some accusing them of making it up, while others suggested that some boys from a local YMCA group had been responsible. This theory was quickly quashed, however, when all the boys were later accounted for on the night in question. And soon, people were flocking in from all over the country, and even from abroad, in the hope of capturing one of the so-called mountain devils. Despite numerous hunting trips, however, no evidence of the creature was ever found. Though Ranger Welch remained convinced that a rational explanation would be forthcoming, as he stated in the Oregonian, Old Man Smith, who started this ape stampede, absolutely believes it. Something happened up there, but I can't imagine what. Another funny thing is that you can't shake the stories of the other men either. The mystery to me is who put up the job on Smith and his companions, and why in the world they did it. A few days later, Fred finally had the chance to visit the dentist to have his tooth extracted. Returning home afterwards, he was approached by a stranger in the street who asked if he was one of the men attacked by the creatures in the forest. When Fred said yes, the man told him there was someone who wanted to talk to him about it, and then invited Fred to accompany him to a tavern across the road. Inside, Fred was introduced to 10 or so Native Americans of the local Yakama tribe who wanted to hear more about his apparent encounter. When Fred had finished telling his story again, the others looked to each other, then one of them began to speak. In their culture, they knew them as the Salatik, a race of outcast Native Americans who'd retreated to the forest where they'd evolved to better suit their environment, becoming superhumanly strong with huge bodies, much bigger than ordinary humans, that were covered in hair to survive the cold. Since they could no longer see in daylight, the Salatik, who lived in deep secluded caves, preferred to hunt at night, and had a long history of abducting the members of other Native American tribes. Fred and his compatriots, it seemed, had had a lucky escape. "So what are they exactly?" asked Fred. "Are they human or spirits?" "Neither," replied the Yakama men. "They were something in between." Thank you to Neil McRobert for suggesting this week's story. Neil has a brilliant podcast called Talking Scared, interviewing writers and advocates of horror, which I thoroughly recommend, so do check it out wherever you get your podcasts.
If you enjoy Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now do so via Patreon. To receive access to ad-free episodes, just go to patreon.com/unexplainedpod to sign up. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, featuring 10 stories that have never before been covered on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Waterstones, among other bookstores. All elements of Unexplained, including the show's music, are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Ocean by H10 Hotels and do your deal at CheapCaribbean.com.